They go after you because you're Asian, correct?
I think that's part of it. And I certainly did not want to whitewash how vitriolic and hate-filled and bigoted the left can be. I think it is a dirty little secret that it is a myth that the left has some sort of moral superiority over the right.
Nobody could believe that and look at the internet.
Well, yeah, certainly.
Right, the left-wing smear websites are worse than the right-wing smear websites. So I think there are unstable people on both sides of the coin.
Well, there's no question about that, but I think that there is a unique level of hypocrisy when these kind of attacks, people making fun of my maiden name for its ethnic sound, for example, talking about my slanted eyes and calling me a gook and telling me to go back to Vietnam or China. This is the left that has always postured itself as above the fray and more civil and more tolerant and more understanding than those of us on the right.
Yeah, there is liberals unhinged.
What I do argue is that a lot of the violence, a lot of the paranoia, the conspiracy theories, a lot of this hatred that I talk about is not relegated to the fringes of the left. We're talking about something that is permeating, a disease that is permeating the leadership up to the top. You know, it wasn't just some fringe crackpot on some college campus who was suggesting on a radio station, for example, that President Bush was tipped off to 9/11. That was the head of the Democratic National Committee, Howard Dean.
Right. He is unhinged. He can't get elected anything, this guy. All right, because the folks know that he's dangerous.
Yeah, they put him in charge of electing everybody else.
No,
come on.
I'll tell you what. I mean, a lot of Democrats don't like him. And I do agree with you that there are certain liberals who are unhinged. So look at the Air America Network. I mean, that's a disgrace. And it's going down the drain. But these are calling for assassinations. I mean, they're way over the top.
But the silence is very telling because it's very rare that you see mainstream Democrats condemning crackpots, condemning people who wish for the president to be killed.
But let me ask you this. Do you see mainstream conservatives condemning Michael Savage?
All the time.
You do?
Of course you do. In fact, I mean, again, I think that this is something that the mainstream media does not recognize. It is, in fact, conservatives who are very outspoken in condemning fringe people and people who are extremists on the right side of the aisle. Yes.
You believe that the strain of fanaticism on the left is much more intense than the strain of fanaticism on the right.
I do, and I also think that there's a level of sanctimony on the left and in the party and a refusal to deal with reality that stretches up to the top of the party that you do not see in the Republican Party. And also there's the double standard in the media. And I'll give you a very specific recent example of this. There's no question about it. But
right.
When Pat Robertson, for example, suggested that the dictator in Venezuela be assassinated, it was all over the TV. I mean, it was wall-to-wall coverage on every morning TV show. But when Randy Rhodes, you just mentioned Air America, and we've talked about this before, when she joked about President Bush being assassinated twice on the air, there was no condemnation at all.
Well,
the New York Times editorialized about the Pat Robertson thing. They said nothing about Randy Rhodes.
All you have to do is count up how many papers review your book. There's no question that the media enables these people to do what they do. And if the same scrutiny was brought to bear on them, then was brought to bear on the right, maybe they wouldn't do it.
I mean, the law of the country.
American media is a business, and it has a mission, not to inform Americans, but to entertain them.
You know, there's happy news for happy people with happy problems.
And the business leaders said that they had to renew with vigor what they called the everlasting battle for the minds of men and indoctrinate citizens with a capitalist story.
Global corporations feeding us the news as they see fit.
Truth is subversive. It's anti-American.
Americans have computers in school, dozens of TV stations, and the most aggressive news media on Earth. Does that mean they're better informed? Hardly.
And now, for Newsreel, here's Sean Kennedy.
And it is a good day. This is Sean Kennedy reporting to you from the Internet for Tuesday, November 15th, 2005. And this would be a Newsreel, the Wall Global sit-rep for core political tyranny, technology, and trends for your headspace and timing. Riot Media is taking a stand for free speech today, and just by listening to this program, you are too, and you can read all the news stories along with me by going to my live journal. And you can get to my live journal by going to sean_kennedy.livejournal.com. This would be a free radio broadcast that can be heard on Rant Radio, Wild Bunch Radio, WNY Media Network, KJAG Radio, OspreyRadio.info, Extreme Radio Tampa, and SRN1. And you yourself are free to distribute this broadcast any way that you see fit. So, how's everyone doing out there in the world this fine Tuesday? You know, Tuesdays are always a very special day to me because I used to remember that the A-Team was on Tuesdays. I wonder how many people out there find it that they can go and they'll remember a certain day. Maybe I'm too old. Maybe you have to be over the age of 30 to remember the point where, you know, before there was VCRs. Because when I was a kid, there was no VCRs, right? If you missed a TV show, baby, it was gone. You missed it. It was toast. And there's something to be said for that. I mean, you learned how to be accountable. You know, you'd have to be in front of the television at 8 o'clock on Tuesday nights on Channel 12 because that was when the A-Team was on. And I watched all the A-Team episodes, bar none. That was my crack growing up. You know what I mean? And I wonder how many other people are like that. But now kids can just be like, yeah, whatever. You know, they have no sense of time or anything like that. Now, mind you, it's pretty sad that I get my sense of time from a TV show. I mean, that's pretty sick and weird anyway. You cut it. But, you know, I mean, everyone's got to have a sense of timing that they get from somewhere. Maybe a method of, well, I suppose, sort of discipline, which is, reminds me of this first piece of feedback I got here. Dear Sean, I came across this quote in the Hagakure, which I'm probably saying that totally wrong. This is the samurai way. But it's the Hagakure way of the samurai. And it just blew my mind, and I thought it would amuse you. The quote is as follows here. Lord Soma's family genealogy called the Chicken Morokashi was the best in Japan. One year, when his mansion suddenly caught fire and was burning to the ground, Lord Soma said, I feel no regret for the house and or all of its furnishing, even if they burn to the very last piece, because these are things that can be replaced later on. I only regret that I was unable to take out the genealogy, which is my family's most precious treasure. There was one samurai among those attending who said, I will go in and take it out. Lord Soma and the others all laughed and said, the house is already engulfed in flames. How are you going to take it out? Now, this man had never been loquacious, nor had he been particularly useful. Being a man who did things from beginning to end, he was engaged as an attendant. At this point, he said, I have never been of use to my master because I'm so careless. But I have lived resolved that someday my life should be of use to him. It seems to me to be that time. And he leapt into the flames. After the fire had been extinguished, the master said, look for his remains. What a pity. Looking everywhere, they found his burnt corpse in the garden adjacent to the living quarters, and when they turned it over, blood flowed out of the stomach. The man had cut open his stomach and placed the genealogy inside, and it was not damaged at all. From this time on, it was called the blood genealogy. Now, this here is a great story. Okay, it's probably even true, which is sick and weird. Now, at the end of the Second World War, after Japan surrendered, there was like hundreds and hundreds of Japanese officers who killed themselves. You know, the whole Divine Wind suicide thing. Now, I am not a fan of suicide. Do not like it. Okay, suicide is just a bad idea. Now, I define suicide as a pointless execution of yourself. You know, killing yourself. Now, what this guy did here... was, I suppose, in some degree, I mean, you have to look at it, it was suicide, but his whole purpose was he died to protect this piece of paper, which had the genealogy on it. Now, this kind of brainless devotion to a person, I mean, this is not good, all right? To be, like, that devoted to your samurai master, I mean, Lord Soma's point of view, yeah, this samurai was the shit. You know, he was kick-ass because he, you know, went in and cut open his guts to save a piece of paper, which was a point of pride for the Lord. You see what I mean? So if he'd have done that to save other lives, if he'd have done that to protect a vaccine, say, if he had not sacrificed his life for the point of pride of his master, that's bad. So the fault really is not the samurai's, other than the fact that he was following his particular life code choice, what have you. The fault in that particular story, in my opinion, well, it lays in the hand with this Lord Soma guy. Because for him to see that this guy was willing to die to protect his genealogy, you know, I mean, that's just ridiculous. But it's an interesting point. It's a really good story. Going on to say here, Dear Sean, dude, The Babylon 5 Menbari, or however you spell it, had three casts, not two. There was, I should have specified, there was more than two casts in that. There were, in fact, three casts. There was the warrior cast, the religious cast, and the worker cast, which I don't think we should have a religious cast of people, because they tried that in Tibet prior to, like, the 1950s or 1940s, something like that. One quarter of the Tibetan population was completely devoted to religious pursuits. And one of the ways that they kept the rest of the working class in Tibet under their rule was they reincarnated debt. So, like, let's say your parents owed, or this guy in the village, like Mark here, was owed, you know, just a stupid amount of money. Well, the next child that was born was obviously Mark reincarnated, so he inherited that debt, and he was born into debt, which is just ridiculous. But this is the same method that a lot of people choose, you know, to passing debt along with families and things like that. So I don't really believe in a religious caste, because they usually wind up being the ruling class. So you have the warrior, the religious, and the worker caste. So I think that what we should have is a system similar in some ways to the whole Babylon 5 Menbari setup, but a lot more akin to the, you know, Robert Heinlein sort of setup. Everything in the world was threes, triangles. Sorry about that, but my uber nerd side starts yelling at me when you say that they have two. And that was from Escarda. Well, congratulations, Escarda. You were a bigger nerd than I, which is not saying any small thing, but that's cool. No, absolutely. There is more than two casts, the Menbari. I had that all wrong. And anybody out there should check out Bab 5, because it's a really good series. That's it. Let's get on to another opinion piece, of which, you know, it's nice when people ask me my opinion, because normally I try to be so unbiased in my broadcasting. Dear Sean, I see a lot of senseless flaming on the internet, as do I. Normally, I just dismiss the offenders as idiotic, immature, or hateful. Dismissing their comments and not participating in their conversation saves me from wasting time. I feel the need, though, to educate these people. Well, the problem with arguing with people on the internet is like running in the Special Olympics. Even if you win, you're still retarded. I feel that need because when they fight, they seem to be pushing against each other. Of course they're pushing against each other. People choose sides, and the communication between people breaks. The transferring of information between them is lost. It's lost because people get emotional. Their emotions break the community. Their emotions impede the ability to communicate and to share information. The internet lives to serve information. The internet is the only communication link we as a human race are all part of. We need to stick together. We need to put aside our emotions so that information can be shared. How do you teach people that? That was sent in by Urban Soldier. And a very good question, Urban. Very, very good question. The only way this can be done is by perspective. You have to be able to take a big step back and not take stuff personally, even when people are savagely attacking you personally. And I have a problem with that. I don't even believe the flame shit I get. People handing me all kinds of stuff. But that's a perspective that you can gain only by experience. Now, the problem here is that people, usually a lot of young people on the internet, are trying to establish themselves and establish their own sense of individuality. Because up until the age of about, you know, your teenage years, they're your parents' child. You're not really anyone except for your parents' child. And gradually, as you go through your teenage years, you start to assert yourself, you start becoming more of an individual, you start having your own wants and needs and likes and all the rest of it, as defined by, you know, a number of different factors. Now then, along comes the internet, and you're able to kind of, in a very virtual way, kind of soiree out into the world, and here you're forming opinions. And you wish to test your opinions against, you know, the greater communal good of everybody else. So what they do is they, you know, they fight. They get out there and they're like, well, I believe this. I think that, you know, this guy was right or that guy was right. I'm with him. And then they define themselves by their belief structure. And then it goes on from there. So they have their individuality is tied up in what their opinions are. And when you start attacking their opinions, you attack their individuality, and of course they start becoming emotional, saying, fuck you, you don't know what you're talking about, rah, rah, rah. Everything gets really, really crazy. So what you need to do is you need to be able to take a step back and isolate your individuality from what people say. Like, realize that no matter what people say, no matter how many people disagree with you, or can, quote-unquote, prove you wrong, which, I mean, that's an interesting statement all in itself. I'm going to prove you wrong. Well, what does that mean? That means that some of my data was flawed. For example, could be argued that this fellow up here, Ascardi, he proved me wrong. Well, yeah, I mean, people make mistakes, and life is an evolution, and you grow and you learn. As you evolve in life, sometimes, you know, Like, for example, there was a time in my life when I went really, really, really left-wing. Heavily left-wing. And then over time and experience, you kind of go, wait a minute, this isn't really working. I don't really see what the solutions are here. And then maybe you come back from being so left-wing and maybe go right-wing. Or the other way around. Maybe you go hardcore left-wing and realize that that path, you know, takes you to the point of, like, being a bloodthirsty monster. And so you start going a little bit more left-wing again. Or, you know, that's just, of course, the predefined meme, you know, of balance. You know, everyone has to have balance. And when you're unbalanced, you're a lot easier to be exploited by either side. And don't you kid yourself. There's a lot of people on the left who want to exploit you just as much as the people on the right. PETA, for example. You know, they'll show you pictures of, you know, animals and all this kind of stuff. And then they're going to ask you, they'll come to you with their handout. Same with, you know, all these sponsorship groups, you know, pay, you know, $20 to sponsor this child. And 18 of it goes to us. $2 goes to the child. You know, a lot of it is money grubbing, and it's people masquerading as crusaders when quite clearly that is not what is going on. So the trick here is to have perspective and to be isolated on some degree. So how do you teach that? Which is the question. How do you teach people this? The only way. Good question, man. Good question. I suppose you could put out a series of films, or you could do a radio show, or you could just talk to people. You could try to run a cult, but you know what? I've kind of tried to start organizations. I've done film work. I've been broadcasting for years now. And it doesn't seem to really be, getting it through to these guys. Because as each generation kind of matures and realizes what the fuck's going on, the next one comes up and they're just as messed up as the first one. So what we have to do is it really falls back to parents. Unfortunately, you got to get to the root cause and to the family unit, which, of course, the media today is dedicated to the destruction of the family unit. I mean, if you watch these television commercials, check out how many times kids are shown to be smarter than the parents. How many times the kids are shown to, totally make the parents look like idiots. Same thing again. You'll always have these scenes where it's quite common for women to slap men in movies. You'll see that all the time. Smack. You know, even in commercials, you know, a guy's looking at a chick and he gets smacked by his wife, right? But how often do you see a guy casually smack his wife in a film? I mean, since all things are equal, right? You know, I mean, instantly, he's the bad guy. You know what I mean? But the chicks can beat the shit out of the guy like it's no problem. I'm not saying that, I agree with smacking women. That's not the point here. The point here is that the women shouldn't be smacking the guy either. This is all social programming. You have to be aware of that. So let's get into the news. And right off the top, I got a piece of feedback related to news. Dear Sean, how would you power your laptop if you're out in the middle of nowhere without a car or a house to take electricity from? Well, it's not actually the car or the house. It's actually just, you know, your power source. But I understand what you're saying. Solar power? Hand cranked? Would it be great to be able to be self-sufficient? It would be great to be self-sufficient without electricity. Well, Ion, send me that in. Of course, there's lots of stuff that makes people need to be, you know, dependent on electricity. Like, computers would not exist without electricity. Arguably the greatest invention by man. You know, the ability to record music, the internet, all that good stuff. So the question here, now there's a lot of solar devices you can use to charge the battery in your laptop. They can be purchased. There's a lot of online hiking places, solar recharges, stuff like that. So I would recommend solar. But if you were going to build yourself an external fire base, because no matter where you are, you have to kind of, you know, provide some sort of stationary location, even if you wind up getting a motorhome. How about this nifty little device, which I've labeled as some WOG gear, called a sunball? The sunball is a solar power source primarily designed for domestic rooftops. Now, that means you could use it with your motorhome or, you know, your boat. I'm a big fan of boats recently as well. Really looking forward to getting into the boat thing. It refracts the sun's light through a wide lens into a minimal number of solar cells. The circular hemisphere design of the unit also enables the solar concentrator to track the sun whilst providing a passive built-in cooling system. The unit is primarily designed to be a cost-effective choice for households interested in generating their own solar energy. Interesting. And if you look at the size of it, it's a lot smaller. So, and apparently it also tracks the sun's movements and stuff like that. So for those of you out there who are pretty interested in the whole solar power thing, this might be something you might want to look into. And in voice over IP news, of course, voice over IP is the big scary thing, right? Everybody knows. Voice over IP is evil. oh my God, it's destroying the phone company's profits, so we have to vilify this. So the latest attempt in vilifying voice over IP comes from, reported by Rogue Trooper. Want to know who's using Skype? Your favorite VoIP, voice over internet protocol software, TerrorStar! Dun, 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 dun! Thereby implying that if you use Skype, you're a terrorist. Security agencies are trying to figure out terror communications post 2910. Have zeroed in terror communications post 2910. What the hell is 2910? 29th of October? Did something happen? 2910? Okay, whatever. Zeroed in on VoIP. Sources say terrorists have used the application from PCs installed by sleeper agents in Delhi and UP. And the terrorists have good reasons. It gives anonymity and secrecy, at least in India, says a source in the intelligence agency. A source. With VoIP communications now legal, security agencies hope the internet surveillance will get better. The number of users, it will now rise. It will automatically figure into the two-track list, a senior official in the IT ministry said. IT officials say it's technically possible to monitor VoIP traffic, but India lags behind in many years. The U.S. uses sophisticated technology to monitor the internet, but even they cannot track VoIP in real time. In India, we are not even looking at VoIP tracking, said an official. Currently, intelligence agencies monitor the international internet gateways on a very minuscule level. VoIP works like email. Everything is broken into bits and transferred through the least busy route over the internet. So, we want to make sure that that looks really, really evil because, especially in India where, a lot of people don't even have regular phones. The cell phone industry is getting set up in there. They're going to make a lot of money from the people in India. So naturally, we got to vilify VoIP as much as we can. This is why I've got to get on board with VoIP pretty quick here. Sim's got a handheld that runs Wi-Fi on his Compaq 6325, I think. So HP 6325, because Compaq got bought out by HP. And he can run Skype on his mobile. So all he's got to do is get to a nice little location where he can find himself some Wi-Fi. Open relay port, spark up his Skype, and bam, he's making phone calls. For free, paying nobody. Gotta like that. Now in Cyberpunk Kit, got some more Cyberpunk Kit here. Some 3D TV sent in by GeoKing. Now this is something that has been in the works for a while, and at first doesn't sound like much, but this is a method to make television three-dimensional and any TV works. International Business Machines, a worldwide leader in technology innovation, has announced a new and affordable 3D video system that works with normal DLP, digital light processing televisions. Before now, 3D video systems would set you back about $1,800, while the price of IBM's new system is expected to be only a grand. If only a grand sounds cheap to you. Of course, that's just your list price right away. That'll probably fall quite quickly. This black box device can be connected to any DLP projector or television via the common VESA, Video Expert Standards Association, 3-pin stereo connector. IBM demonstrated the new system on a 50-inch flat-screen Texas Instruments rear projection digital television at the 22nd annual Flat Information Display Conference held in San Francisco this month. Now, this is pretty interesting because, you could take this and take a relatively cheap old TV and turn it into a massive 3D display for, whatever gaming platform, Xbox, what have you. This was on the drawing board for about two years, and now we're at the conceptual proof of concept stage. We're here to look for manufacturing partner to bring the technology to market, said Jim Santro, a technology licensing programmer from the IBM's office of Poughkeepsie near IBM's corporate headquarters in Armrock, New York. IBM tends to develop cutting-edge technology and then license it to third-party manufacturers rather than build and sell finished products, which is why they had a wearable out years ago, but nobody ever produced it, so we wound up standing around with our dicks in our hands. This strategy allows them to keep pouring funds into basic research and cutting-edge technology. It also permits wide dissemination of its technologies throughout the industry, increasing chances for permanent adoption over competing technologies. Exact details concerning the 3D technology, still unnamed, were not forthcoming. But the company spokesman said it was compatible with OpenGL and DirectDraw, both software components of the Microsoft Windows operating system that allow programmers to manipulate video for computer games. Now, bear in mind, you do still have to wear glasses with this. As I understand it, you do still have to wear glasses. So it's not so unlike, you know, doing the stutter effect, but it now works with televisions. Now, what would be interesting to do, does that mean that I can now watch The Matrix in 3D? Is that what that means? Because that would be really hot. You could watch all these old movies in 3D. Now, that is definitely sexy. Now, in brain space news, now this is an interesting sort of story because Japan, of course, has adopted cell phones, and they generally adapt technology a lot quicker than everybody else does. So what they have here is going bananas over mobile phones for so many is turning Japanese into monkeys, according to Sapio, which is some dude, I guess, or some sort of entertainment source. Nobu Masataka, professor at the Kyoto University Primate Research Institute and author of the monster bestseller Ketwa One Matasaru, which is literally translates to monkeys with mobile phones, argues that the proliferation of mobile phones has gotten young Japanese making monkeys of themselves, aping the behavior patterns of chimpanzees. And I really hope this guy stops, you know, using monkey metaphors in his report. He says that young Japanese have lost the ability to discern between public and private space. Interesting, considering that, you know, there really is no difference between public and private space thanks to the surveillance state technology. He adds that they have formed what he calls the Daruki Zoku, Out and About Tribe. Now, there's a great clan name right there. The Daruki, D-E-A-R-U-K-I-Z-O-K-U. Daruki Zoku, the Out and About Tribe, which is pretty much wogs. There's been a dramatic increase in the Daruki Zoku. They don't eat meals at home with family members, and you can clearly see with your own eyes the large increase in young people who hang out about on the streets together with the same old friends. Aha! Matsuka tells Sapio. They make places like Shibuya their territory and rarely even head out to places like the nearby entertainment and shopping districts. Shinjuku or Harajuku. They get tired of going to new places and meeting new people. If they get hungry while they're strolling around, they simply get food by going to a convenience store, buying something, and sitting down on the curb to eat it. If not that, then they just hang out for hours and hours at fast food joints. Now, this to me seems surprising that this is a trend now in Japan, because this sort of stuff has been going on for years in North America. The primate specialist says the actions of the Daruki Zoku closely resemble behavior patterns in chimpanzees, which tend to travel in groups, walking around for a long time without going any place in specific, then eating and disposing of their waste in the same place before bedding down on piles of grass whenever the inclination takes them. Well, I can't really say as I'm too surprised there, but it's an interesting, you know, sort of metaphor that they say that, oh, wow, mobile phones are destroying our culture because now they can be communicated everywhere and the concept of home is being lost. And is that a bad thing? Does that mean that people will be more concerned with their environment as a whole rather than just their own personal space? Or will we just, you know, start slowly devolving into this hardcore nomadic culture? Something to check out. I don't know. Now, another piece of cyberpunk kit here. We've got brush gum. This was sent to me by GeoKing. Now, this is one of those things as well. Nobody Special sent me that that one on the Brain Space and Rogue Trooper on VoIP. So I haven't. Occasionally, I stop mentioning people's names when I do these stories, but I do appreciate everyone who sends it in. But GeoKing sent me this one here, too. Cyberpunk kit is brush gum. Now, of course, there's always, you know, these gums that come out, claim that they fight tooth decay, all this kind of stuff. But apparently, there's a military application for this gum. Now, I don't know if this is legit, if somebody can give me a report on this, if they know somebody who's in. But apparently, U.S. soldiers are set to add a new killing machine to their arsenal, one that wipes out bacteria. Chewing gum could help troops avoid the frequent dental problems that arise in the field for days on end without cleaning their teeth. Oral hygiene may not sound like a serious problem for soldiers on maneuvers, but U.S. military experts point out that both tooth and gum problems can be debilitating. About 15% of deployed soldiers have experienced dental emergencies, such as gum infection, says Kay Lung of the U.S. Army Dental Research Detachment in Great Lakes, Illinois. The gum, developed by U.S. Army researchers, contains a protein that attacks the bugs that cause plaque, which in turn lead to gum infections and tooth decay. Soldiers can keep their mouths clean without toothpaste, brush, and bathroom sink, its creators say. So whether or not this stuff actually works, it could just be another spin on this gum. Trials of the gum's active ingredient, a protein fragment called KSL, danger, show that it kills harmful mouth bacteria. such as Streptococcus mutans growing on discs of tooth-like material in the lab. The next step will be to test the gum in the field, which of course they'll just give it to the troops, and hopefully it won't make them grow any third arms. The gum could be useful to anyone away from their bathroom for days at a time, adds Patrick DeLuca, the University of Kentucky in Lexington, who presented the team's results at a recent annual meeting of the American Association of Pharmaceutical Scientists in Nashville, Tennessee. Oh, big pharma's in there. Good to see. This chewing gum formulation could have numerous potential uses, not only for the military, but also for the avid outdoorsman or anyone else on the go. Might include anyone from aid workers to music festival goers. Well, I suppose. I mean, personally, I'd rather just bring along a toothbrush, but, you know, that's just me. That's just me. Who knows? You know, I mean, why don't they combine this with the caffeine gum so you can have caffeine, you know, caffeine tooth decay gum or anti-tooth decay caffeine gum or something like that. Now, here's an interesting story. Now, you may have heard of the Tibetan Book of the Dead as well as the Egyptian Book of the Dead. Now, there was a copy of the Tibetan Book of the Dead that was floating around, but it is not a complete rendition. And just apparently recently, for the first time in over 1,300 years, the Great Tibetan Book of the Dead has now been translated into English. Now, this is a text that I'm going to be trying to get my hands on. For a text about dying that is said to have been composed in the 8th century for the benefit of a Tibetan king, the Tibetan Book of the Dead has enjoyed a surprisingly enduring, adaptable, and eventful life, hidden from the world at large for more than 1,000 years. It was not until the 20th century that it first appeared in English translation, going on to serve variously as an academic textbook, occult curiosity, and accoutrement to the hippie lifestyle. Over the years, it has been interpreted as a quasi-theosophical treaty, a guide to psychoanalysis and the New Age self-help book. But extraordinarily, not until now has it ever appeared in full. So they've never actually had a full copy of this until recently. The Tibetan Book of the Dead stands alongside Dante's Divine Comedy, of which I happen to own a first edition copy of, thank you very much, as one of the great literary works on the afterlife. But while Dante's work is fiction designed for moral instruction, the Book of the Dead offers quite a literal description of what happens to the mind at death, a user's guide, as it were, to the post-mortem state. The book elaborates Tibetan Buddhist teachings about the journey of the consciousness through the three stages or bardos of dying, the moment of death, the immediate state between death and rebirth, and the process of rebirth itself. Central to the text is the belief that death presents the greatest opportunity to gain liberation, and so to step off the endless wheel of suffering that is held to characterize worldly existence. Hence, you know, the world is suffering, people equals shit, all that good stuff. The book was said to have been comprised by an Indian yogi, and I'm going to try to say his name here, Padmasambhava, who is credited with introducing Buddhism into Tibet in the 8th century, which a lot of people don't realize, but there was religion there before that. There was a tribal version of religion there before Tibet, before Buddhism hit Tibet, which is very interesting stuff if you can ever get any information on it. In the 8th century, and regarded as the founding father of the esoteric tradition, like hundreds of his teachings, the text was supposedly transcribed in a cryptic language and secreted as a treasure text to be discovered at a time when it was appropriate to be transmitted to the general populace. Now, this is all part of this, you know, you get this a lot with the whole, hidden knowledge crowd, you know. Esoteric hidden knowledge. When the time is right, you know, this knowledge is not for everybody. It's only for those select few, and those select few who know it become priests and are therefore lorded over everybody else and gives them status and power. And it's all bullshit. It was found in the 12th century, hidden amongst the mountains in Tibet by a treasure seeker. It's here for the treasure seekers, known as Karma Lingpa, who deciphered the cryptic text and passed on the teachings orally to his son. It was several generations when it was finally written down, becoming one of the central teachings of the Tibetan Buddhist canon. The first English translation appeared in 1927, edited by the American theosophist named Walter Evans Wentz, who came across the text while traveling in India. It had been given to him by a British Army officer who had recently returned from Tibet. Evans Wentz commissioned a translation from the Tibetan who taught English at a boys' school and published it as the Tibetan Book of the Dead. I wonder if the guy who translated it made any money on that sucker. Probably not. But, you know, that's the way the world works. Now, is that cool? I guess so. I mean, you know, handy to know. But when you take that story and going it also with this other occult story I got from Ascarta. It's kind of occult, but it applies. Just listen up here. Meditation, not medication. Well, medication too, but meditation apparently alters brain patterns in ways that are likely permanent. Physically alters the brain. Scientists have known. But a new study shows key parts of the brain actually get thicker through the practice. So the brain physically changes. Brain imaging of regular working folks who meditate regularly revealed increased thickness in cortical regions related to sensory, auditory, and visual perceptions, as well as internal perception, the autonomic monitoring of heart rate and breathing, for example. Very interesting. The study also indicates that regular meditation may slow age-related thinning of the frontal cortex. Whoa! Does good stuff for the brain. What's most fascinating to me is the suggestion that meditation practice can change anyone's gray matter, says study team member Jeremy Gray, an assistant professor of psychology at Yale. The study participants were people with jobs and families. They just meditated on average for 40 minutes each day. That's it. 40 minutes a day, and you're on the road to, you know, getting the brain being pretty healthy. Maybe even supernatural. The research was led by Sarah Lazar, assistant in psychology at the Massachusetts General Hospital. It is detailed in a November issue of the Journal of the Neuro Report. The study involved a small number of people, just 20, all had extensive training in Buddhist insight meditation. Now, that's what they're saying here. They're doing Buddhist insight meditation. But researchers say the results are significant. Most of the brain regions identified by the changes through meditation were found in the right hemisphere, which is essential for sustaining attention. And attention is the focus of meditation. Other forms of yoga and meditation likely have a similar impact on brain structures, other researchers speculate. But each tradition probably has a slightly different pattern of cortical thickening based on the specific mental exercise involved. Which means that anything you do for 40 minutes a day that's largely cerebral will probably affect your mind. That probably includes also reading. So if you're going to read, you just read for an hour every day. Very interesting stuff. I think perhaps I should give this a try. I think perhaps I should take a far more hardcore approach to meditation. But then the question comes into being, what meditation do you try? The only meditation I'm really aware of is ones where you become super, you kind of dump all thoughts and say, stay psycho-attentive to your environment. You sort of turn everything up. It's very hard to do. Depending on the person, I find it pretty difficult to do. But it's something that you can work on, and if you can do it for like 5 minutes to start, work your way up to 40 minutes, hell, you're doing really sweet. It's all about releasing things and remaining present within the moment, something you may wish to work on. Something that might be extremely helpful as well, and apparently is something that actually physically affects what your brain looks like. Very interesting. Now, in intellectual property madness news, this is pretty wacko. The Royal Canadian Legion has told an Ottawa-based internet news site to stop using its poppy image to promote Remembrance Day. Now, the Legion has done some dumb fucking shit, but this is pretty stupid. Pierre Bourque removed the Canadian poppy symbol from his website and replaced it with a British poppy image after warning emails from the Legion's Poppy and Remembrance Committee. Now, the committee said unauthorized use of the poppy symbol could reduce the flower's value as a symbol of war and remembrance, according to email experts of the Bourque post that Bourque posted on his site. The poppy is a trademark of the Legion. Anyone who wants to use it has to apply, wrote Bob Butte, the communications director of the organization's Dominion Command. Otherwise, it would be all over the place. But the email added, sorry, I know your heart, many others, is in the right place. So at least they apologize, but they just have to protect their poppies, I guess. Though Bourque has taken the Canadian poppy image from his site, he defended his usage of the graphic in a message posted on his site over the weekend. Bourque Newswatch was merely promoting Remembrance Week and the Royal Canadian Legion, honoring those men and women who have fought and given so much for us, he wrote. Nothing more, nothing less. Bourque has also said a quick internet search found 589 Remembrance poppy images in less than a tenth of a second. He pointed out that the Royal British Legion actively encourages groups to download and use its poppy symbol for maximum online visibility. Now, I can understand perhaps, if the Legion got all pissed off because somebody was making, like, a Remembrance brand poppy. Or maybe, like, some supremacist group was trying to use a poppy as some sort of a symbol that it was never designed to be used for, and therefore twisting the meaning of the symbol. I could understand that. But to be this much of an asshole about the whole thing, I don't know. I don't know if I agree with that. I think it's pretty stupid of the Legion. And on that note, I know a man who just recently Canada lost its last living VC winner. And I knew a man that knew that man. It was on the same beach and lost his arm, actually. Same place where Buddy died. Or, pardon me, the same place where Buddy won the VC. I was on this little beach in Italy. And he was telling me that the Royal Canadian Legion really doesn't do a shit of a lot for vets. That was his take. Now, granted, that's one man's speech as he's talking to me. But I guess, you know, like so many other organizations like Greenpeace and like, well, all these other guys, eventually the use of the organization changes. How much is actually left for the veterans? How many people in the Legion are even war vets themselves or have even served? It used to be that you had to be, you know, a serviceman or servicewoman to join the Legion. Now they let anybody in. Is that good? Is that bad? I don't know. But it seems to me that maybe the vets and what the whole Legion's about might be getting forgotten in the mix somewhere. Now, in webcash news, now here's an interesting story. Robert Petrick searched the word, Robert Petrick, who's on trial, searched for the words neck, snap, break, and hold on an internet search engine before his wife died, according to prosecutors said on Wednesday. More than 2 years after Janine Steffen's body was discovered floating in Raleigh Lake, investigators continue to find new evidence on computers seized from Robert Petrick's home that prosecutors say support their arguments that Petrick killed his wife. So what he was looking at online, you know, that's what they're using as evidence. The Google search was the latest in a recently discovered evidence found on nearly a dozen computers seized from Petrick's home. Last week, a forensic investigator discovered that Petrick allegedly researched lake levels, water currents, boat ramps, and access about Falls Lake just 4 days before he reported Steffen missing on January 22, 2003. Two of Steffen's sons also testified Wednesday that they suspected their stepfather in their mother's death. I had to follow my gut and did not feel safe or trust this man, said Robin Steffen. He told jurors that when he had not heard from his mother in over a two-week period, he called Petrick and threatened to come to North Carolina to find out what was wrong. The next day, Petrick reported Steffen missing. Now, Mal Cab, who sent me in this story, said it best. He said, bad. You have to do a Google search to learn how to break your wife's neck. Worse, your Google search history is used against you in a court to find you guilty. I'm glad the guilty is getting justice, but learning that your Google search history can be used against you in court is kind of creepy. Luckily, I don't think your average WOG would use Google to learn how to break someone's neck. Well, WOGs don't hurt people, generally. That's sort of a big rule. I always like to go with that. There's a lot of inspiration here where, you know, defense of the home and all that kind of jazz. I would think that WOGs would be kind of noble, upstanding folks who wouldn't be out there murdering their spouses. Spouse-I. Multiple spouses. So it is kind of interesting to note here that Google search histories can be used against you in a court. Is that bad? Is it bad? I mean, should, you know, if you've got, you go and you check a guy's computer and he's got, you know, all his searches on, you know, how to mutilate bodies and there's a bunch of people being mutilated in the local region, you know, and, you know, it's, does that make him a suspect? I would say, yeah. I mean, you know, it's something that's a factor. At least it makes him part of the short list until you can kind of maybe narrow it down. Because after all, it's about discovering the truth. That's what's important here, is discovering the truth. And a lot of something gets forgotten by people sometimes. People get more concerned with, I mean, don't get me wrong, I do think it's important for people to have civil liberties and all that kind of jazz. But what is important is that the job gets done. That's a big thing. Now, in Cyberpunk Kit, another piece is Silly String. This is a really cool story. This is sent to me by No Delete. And it's from a site called What's Inside, and they talk about how much is quantities and stuff like that. And the guy who ran this site got this letter, and the letter reads as follows. I'm a former Marine in Afghanistan. Silly String has served me well in combat, especially when looking for IEDs. Simply put, booby traps. When you spray the Silly String in dark areas, especially when you're doing house-to-house fighting, on many occasions, the Silly String has saved my men's lives. See, what happens is, when you spray the silly string into the darkness, it like hangs on the threads. And you go to the link following this, you can see how it shows tripwire. Now, my little brother has taken up the fight in Iraq, where he is a house-to-house fighting his intents. And to get to the point, I would like to purchase a large amount of silly string to send to him to help with the booby traps. When you spray the silly string, it just spreads everywhere, and it lays right on the wire. Even in dark room, the string stands out to reveal the tripwire. Very, very cool. And he goes on to say here that he was looking for prices for bulk orders of stuff for the guys fighting over there. And I thought that that was just the coolest application ever. You know, and that this guy here, the dude who wrote this in, his name is Sergeant Dennis Hernandez, HHC2/502 Infantry, 101st Airborne Division Assault, AASLT, it's all in abbreviations, APO AE09398. So if anyone wanted to drop him a letter and just say, yo, hey, mail is like gift from God. Mail is gifts from God when you're overseas. But for anyone who wants to know, looking for tripwires, silly string is the shit. Now that is a handy piece of intel right there. I think that is just a really cool concept and a very good idea. And something that, you know, has been there, kind of done that sort of mentality. So I'm all about that. I think it's a very cool idea. Now, doctors, now this is an interesting story here, too, because it's related to plague news. It's actually HIV news, sent in by Paradin. Doctors say they want to investigate the case of a British man with HIV who apparently became clear of the virus. Doesn't have HIV anymore. Andrew Stimson, 25, was diagnosed HIV positive in 2002, was found to be negative in October of 2003 by Chelsea and Westminster Healthcare NHS Trust. Mr. Stimson from London said he was one of the luckiest people alive. I don't think luck has anything to do with it. The Trust said that the tests were accurate, but had been unable to confirm Scotsman Mr. Stimson's cure because he had declined to undergo further tests. A statement from the Trust said, "This is a rare and complex case. When we became aware of Mr. Stimson's HIV negative test results, we offered him further tests to help us investigate and find an explanation of the different results. So far, Mr. Stimson has declined this offer." Well, I can understand that he might be pretty freaked out about the whole thing. A Trust spokeswoman added, "We urge him, for the sake of himself and other and the HIV community, to come in and get tested. If he doesn't feel that he can come to Chelsea and Westminster, then he should please go to another HIV specialist." There have been anecdotal accounts before from Africa of people shaking off the HIV virus. Now, I had not heard that. Mr. Stimson, who was originally from Largs in Ayrshire, said there are 34.9 million people with HIV globally, and I am just one person who managed to control it, to survive from it, and get rid of it from my body. For me, that's unbelievable. It's a miracle, and I think I'm one of the luckiest people alive. Well, arguably, I would say that if it's true and this guy has got something in his body that can defeat HIV, we need to know about it. And I think those 34.9 million people are more important than, you know, this one Mr. Stimson. So, Mr. Stimson, you should really go and figure out why you were able to shake this off, because you could save millions of lives. Literally, millions of lives. You selfish fuck. Mr. Stimson told the News of the World and Mail on Sunday that he became depressed and suicidal after being told he was HIV positive, but remained well and did not require medication. So apparently, there is an ability to, you know, get this stuff out of your system. It's something that can be done. I'd never heard of it before, but apparently it's a reality. Today's daily hack is Bluetooth scanning. Now, this is like war driving, only I guess this is what would you call this? Like Smurf war driving? Blue war driving? Blue driving? I don't know, what would you call this? While enterprises have become increasingly aware of security concerns surrounding the 802.11, that's the Wi-Fi standard, Bluetooth vulnerabilities have continued to be ignored. With over 5 million Bluetooth radios being shipped a week, organizations must address the Bluetooth threat and begin to detect and prevent insidious attacks. Network Chemistry BlueScanner is provided for free and is included with the RF Project Mobile Suite to discover Bluetooth devices, their type, phone, computer, keyboard, PDA, etc., and the services that are advertised by the devices. It will identify any discoverable devices within range and record all the information that can be gathered from the devices without authenticating with it. This includes the device's human-friendly name, unique address type, the type of device itself, time and discovery, last time last seen, and any SDG information provided by the device. Very interesting stuff, available for free. And there's a couple other ones there that do the same thing, all thanks to Data Maggot for submitting them for today's Daily Hack. And that's all I got for you today. But don't worry, I will be back tomorrow to make sure you get all the information you need to stay alive. This has been a free radio broadcast brought to you by the generous donations of 11 one-time donators, 52 continuing subscribers, 2 new subscribers, for a total of 65 people who seem to believe that Newsreel is worth something. And if you would like to help keep this daily news broadcast on the air, please visit randmedia.ca and click on the Donate tab. Thanks again to everyone and their assistance in gathering data. If you have access to sensitive information or any of the pertinent stories, please email them to Newsreel. That's N-E-W-S-R-E-A-L at randradio.com. If you like the music in the background, be sure to pick up the album by Perpetual Dream Theory called No Now or Never. Very, very cool album. I'm going to leave you now with a track by Peter Gabriel called The Barry Williams Show, which is somewhat reminding of what the media is all about today. So until tomorrow, that is what server said. End of line.
One man at the window, one girl at the bar. Saw the look of recognition when they know just who you are. Seen you on the TV, I seen you on that show. You make the people crazy, and then you let them go. Before the show, we calm them, we sympathize, we care. And the hostile folk we keep apart till the red light says on air. Did you see our leather lovers all tied up to the chair? Did you catch those child molesters? No one else goes there. What a show! What a show! Always reach so high.
she conceived, so they'd let her take my place. Well, no man is an island, no man is a sea, but this display of emotion is all but drowning me. What a show. Ever seen where people say the things that they really mean? I hear my name, I hear them roar. For the one more time, I take the floor. Just one more Barry Williams show. We're gonna take you where you want to go.
Thank you.